Where did the bank come from? It might seem like banks have always been here, trustworthy establishments that keep our money safe. And even though banks in their modern form trace their roots back to 12th century Italy, the institutions have been evolving constantly, and what they'll look like in the future remains an open question. Here to tell this story is Paolo Zanoni, author of the new book, Money and Promises, Seven Deals That Changed the World. Paolo is the executive deputy chairman of the board of Prada, president of Prada Holding, and international advisor to the executive office of Goldman Sachs International. Here he is to share five of his big ideas.
Good day, everyone. This is Paolo Zanoni, president of Prada Holding. In my book, Money and Promises, there are several ideas. Here, I would tell you about five of them. Modern money is debt, the debt of banks. We say we go to the bank to get money or that we borrow money from the bank. But we got it all wrong. Whether we are paying with debt or credit cards, electronic transfer, the goods and services we buy are paid with our bank's debt, its promises to pay. And what is true of us as individuals is true also of nations and states. Today, sovereign currencies everywhere are made mostly of bank debts. This simple fact explains a lot about the role of banks in society and their relationship with government. In matters of money, banks and states are partners. They support each other. That is why, when banks get in trouble, governments bail them out. This book explains how we got there. It all began in Pisa, and it began with the ideas of one man, Fibonacci. Fibonacci has spent time trading in the southern Mediterranean, where he learned Arabic and Indian mathematics. In its Liber Abaci, written in 1202, he outlined the advantages of Arabic and Indian mathematics over the Roman system. Fibonacci is the system that is taught in school today the world over. But that is not all. Liber Abaci was not a theoretical enterprise, but a book made for merchants and bankers, a guide to making money from money. It should be understood as a textbook for aspiring financiers. Soon, School of Abaci were set up to train apprentices for banks and merchant houses. Banking knowledge and practices spread. The Republic of Pisa benefited from the spread of financial and banking knowledge. When Pisa lost its colonies with their silver money, the inflow of precious metals slowed, and the mint could not produce the coins needed to trade and manufacture. But the golden age of Pisa did not end there. Trade and industry still prospered. Bankers issued debt to traders, manufacturers, and state institutions. And bank debt money supported the state, industry, and trade. Thus, Pisa prospered because in the Republic there were two types of money, coins from the mints and debt of the local bank. Now that we have seen how it all started in Pisa, let's move to Venice. Rialto is one of the oldest words in the city of Venice. This unlikely spot was once the financial center of the Western world. Wall Street and the City of London squeezed into just a few square yards. In the early 1600s, Juan Vendramin was a bullion dealer in Rialto. He purchased gold and silver on the world market and sold it to the mint. But if the mint price was lower than the price on the world market, the flow of bullion into the mint dwindled or stopped, and so did the supply of coin money. The economy and public finances of the Republic suffered, and so did Vendramin's income. That is exactly what was happening in 1619. Then Vendramin approached the Senate with an idea. He was willing to sell silver to the mint at full price, but he could be flexible on the means of payment. For half the value, he would want coin, but for the other half, he would accept the debt of a special kind of bank. It was a cunning plan and came at the right time. The Banco Giro was born, a bank to serve the state. Banco Giro, an institution of the state, was the first public bank to issue bank debt money to public offices. soon other nations look at the Venetian experiment to make their own public banks. England moved first. A tally is a stick used to record financial information. In England, from the 12th century for over 600 years, tallies became the most used financial instrument, the backbone of public finance and banking. When citizens loaned money to the king, the royal tally cutter recorded the name of the lender and the sum loaned on each side of the stick. Then he split the stick lengthwise. The exchequer kept one piece, the lender the other. Only those two pieces could fit together as proof of the loan and the debt. The stick was a valid claim on tax revenues. This is how the English king borrowed from his subjects for hundreds of years. But by the late 1600s, the system was in crisis. Too many tallies had been cut, and the sticks were not worth much. Enter an ingenious Scot, William Paterson. He had promoted many schemes. The Bank of England was his most ambitious and the most successful. The idea was simple. The exchequer cut tallies and delivered one half to the bank in exchange for banknotes, bank debt, money. The bank was paid a fee to exchange public debt for bank debt, and the state got instantly available purchasing power. The scheme was successful, so successful that the Bank of England became the most copied public bank in the world. Later, the North American colonies turned the scheme against England itself. It was the scarcity of coins that pushed the North American colonies to set up a currency made of debts, something not done on such a large scale before. In 1689, the colony of Massachusetts, having no coins, paid its citizen soldiers fighting the French Canadians with bills of credit they could use to pay taxes. The gimmick worked because when the taxes became due, the citizen gave the bills back to the colony and the reciprocal indebtedness was cleared. The Continental Congress, which governed independent colonies from 1776 to 1789, enlarged the practice by issuing lots of bills of credit. Each bill was a promise by Congress to pay a Spanish silver dollar. This bill could also be used to pay taxes, but the politics of Continental Congress did not encourage tax raising and compliance. Too many bills remained in circulation, the purchasing power collapsed. But Robert Morris, the superintendent of finance of the Continental Congress, had an idea on how to increase the purchasing power of public debt. He set up the Bank of North America, owned by Congress and private shareholders. As soon as the bank opened for business, Morris handed the bank a promissory note for $100,000, public debt. In exchange for the note, he got back $97,000 worth of banknotes. The notes of the bank held their value because they were debts of the bank, money. And everyone accepted them, even in the Confederation of Independent States. This way, the US dollar was born, a national currency made only of debts. In February 1990, I moved to Moscow. I went there to close a deal. The sale of 50% of the USSR biggest car company to Fiat. The deal had been agreed between Gorbachev and Gianni Agnelli, Fiat's chairman. All that was required was to close the deal. The job fell to me. The USSR was disintegrated and I needed a guy to find my way around the maze. I was lucky. I found one in Vladimir Yakovlev, the editor-in-chief of Kommersant, the new Russia version of The Economist. Vladimir explained to me that since 1917, Russia had two economies, not one, each taking its name from a Moscow landmark. The first was the Red Square economy. This was made of state-owned enterprise run by communist state institution housed in the Red Square. The second was the so-called Sukarevka economy, which took its name from a very old open-air market in Moscow. Here, hawkers, peddlers, and bagmen traded anything and everything. Cash was king in the Sukarevka. Here it was profit, not Communist Party rules, that motivated the participant. The respective size and importance of the two economies have varied in the 70 years of the Soviet Union. But never one economy has been able to do without the other. The sale of the car company to Fiat was squarely in the province of the Red Square economy. But with the USSR collapsing, closing the deal was impossible, and I left. 22 years later, I found myself in Moscow again to head Goldman Sachs in Russia. The Sukarevka economy had grown and the Red Square diminished, but they were still working side by side. Understanding the Sukarevka and the Red Square, these fundamental features of the Russian economy, is key to make sense of the role that money and banking played in the Bolshevik experiment, and what went right and wrong in Lenin's plan, and in those of Stalin, Gorbachev, and Putin.
Thank you, Paolo. That was Paolo Zanoni with five big ideas from Money and Promises, Seven Deals That Changed the World. Also check out our book bite for The Money Kings, the epic story of the Jewish immigrants who transformed Wall Street and shaped modern America by Daniel Shulman. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.